Okay, well, I'm going to get started here. Try to get set up. Thank you all for coming. Welcome to my talk. This is a very likely controversial topic for a lot of people. And my goal with this is to see us all on a journey through life, questioning the bigger questions of life. And this is not to cause division. As a Christian speaking on evidence for God, some of my three biggest support people in my life are three friends who are atheists, two of which are from Mensa. So in fact, when I sent my name in to suggest I speak here, I gave one reference only, my atheist friend from Mensa. So I just want to say that we look around the room, what you have in common with the person next to you is an interest in looking at the big pictures of life in an open mind, part of your journey of life, and it doesn't really matter at this point what conclusions you've come to or what you believe. You're at least willing to be an open mind and investigate things. So my hope is that this brings unity in the searching of life and asking questions and discussion and not something that causes division. So that's my goal. And a couple things, hold questions till the end. I'm going to allow plenty of time for Q&A. And also, my talk is designed for an audio-only format because I'm recording it. Very likely there'll be more people hearing it by recording as opposed to that are in this room. And you never want to hear a recording where they say, well, on slide 7 you see such and such. So I won't be referring to the slides. They're just there as extra support. So if you hear me describing something that you see in a slide, that's why it's for an audio audience. So with that in mind, and with that in mind of, again, not wanting something divisive, I am going to give you a very challenging talk. So kind of I'm going to push this pretty hard, so be ready for something that's pretty challenging. And I want to start with a question. Does science play a role in what you believe in life? And I want you to think about that and ask that honestly as we go on a journey. I'd like you to follow me on a journey to a place where science, logic, and rational thought are a basis for what we believe, and you'll see one of the reasons I'm a Christian. So we're going to have a lot of ground to cover. I'm going to cover 8 areas of science. Before I get into that, I want to talk about 4 views of nature. And the first is naturalism. And this is the idea that everything we see in nature is purely by natural causes. And granted, if you're an atheist, you would take a naturalistic point of view. But there are people that will still believe that there's a spiritual realm. It's just that it wasn't part of creating the universe or anything that we see. So that's why I can't say the theistic view versus the atheist view, because the word atheist is too narrow. I'll say naturalist view. So that's the purpose of that term. The second thing is what's called a young earth creationist. And this is somebody that believes that God created the universe and the earth about 6,000 to 10,000 years ago. And this is based off of the story in Genesis where it talks about God creating in 6 days and interpreting that Hebrew word used for day is a 24-hour period. Next is an old earth creationist. This is that God created everything in long but finite periods of time. So that fits very well with our present age of the universe. And that's interpreting the word day as being an era. And the last would be a theistic evolutionist, which would take the same view as an old earth creationist, except when it comes to life forms. And that's to what extent is evolution a part of where life forms came, or was it more of a direct creative process by a God? The reason I bring this up is because whenever the news wants to interview somebody that's a creationist, usually they find a young earth creationist because it's the least credible and the easiest, the hardest to defend. So I don't want you to confuse what I say with other people say. And by the way, same with naturalism, there's a lot of different views on that. So now we're ready to start into science. The first area we want to get to is the beginning of our universe. And to start with that, I want to talk about 4 views of time itself. The first is that time is circular. And this is more of a mythological view that, if we get older, we'll have kids, our kids will have kids, and eventually we'll die off. And when in the future, our grandparents are going to be born, our parents will be born, and we'll be born again to live the exact same life. It's sort of like life is on a treadmill on an infinite loop. And that's more of a that's definitely a mythological view that has not played any role in modern science. The next three views play a strong role in the 20th century. And the next one is that time is cyclical. An example of this is the academic year. Okay, you start school in September, you enroll in your classes, you take your classes, oh, you gotta go for midterms, eventually finals, then spring semester, you hit summer vacation, then you're back in school September again, same college perhaps, but classes are different. Some of the people are the same, some are different. It's a very similar experience, a very similar cycle, but not the same one. So that's cyclical. The next is linear infinite. This is that, know that time doesn't cycle. It just goes in one direction. But if you go back in time, no matter how far you go back in time, you can always take one step farther back. The time goes infinite in the past. It may go infinite in the future, may not, but probably most likely go infinite in the future. But at least there is no beginning. Time goes infinitely far back. And the last is linear finite, that the time may continue infinitely, we don't know, but at least going back, you can go back in time, but you'll hit a place where you can't go back any farther. You've hit some type of boundary, some type of beginning. That's linear finite. So prior to the 20th century, we had what's called the steady state model. And this is the notion, that the universe always existed. There was no beginning. If it began, it was trillions of years ago, but not billions of years ago. And also they felt the universe is infinitely large, and it was kind of a very static situation. A lot of good reasons to think this in terms of what was known in the 1900s. Now, what happens is, and also with no beginning, there's no need for a beginner, no need for a creator. This would conflict with perhaps the theologian that might say that there's a beginning, the philosophers. And you can make a philosophical argument, perhaps, for a beginning and say, well, if the universe had a beginning, how would we know? It's not like we can see back in time. You know, just maybe make a philosophical argument. But that's kind of where you were. But at this point, pondering the beginning of the universe was not an area of science, but more an area of theologians and philosophers. So some two main changes happened in the 20th century. The discovery of something called the redshift and Einstein's theory of relativity. So let me go into the redshift first. There's something called the Doppler effect. And if you stood on the side of the road and hear a car drive by, it goes, this goes by. And that's because as it's coming towards you, the car is compressing the sound waves, and they sound at a higher pitch. As it's passing you, it's stretching the sound waves, they sound at a lower pitch. Okay, so that's something we've all kind of experienced. Well, an interesting thing is, the same thing happens with light. If that car was moving fast enough, it would look bluer as it comes towards you, but obviously cars can't move fast relative to the speed of light. But if like a star or an object in the universe is moving towards you, that star is going to look a little bit bluer than it should. How we know what color a star should be, maybe I'll take that up in the Q&A, that's quite complicated, but just kind of accept that for now. If the star is moving away from us, it's going to look a little redder than we would expect. Okay, and what happened is astronomers started looking at these far objects off in space and noticed they were more red than they expected. Now, closer to us, there are some objects that are blue-shifted, that are moving towards us, like our nearest galaxy, the Andromeda galaxy, is actually blue-shifted and moving towards us. Once you get out of our local group of galaxies, everything's red-shifted. It means it's moving away. The farther away an object is, the bigger the redshift, which means the faster it's moving away. So if you think about that, that means that the universe is expanding. Okay, everything's moving away from us. Now, the mind-boggling part of this, and this is just a huge thing for astronomers to wrap their minds around, if you roll the clock backwards on an expanding universe, everything's coming together, you've got it contracting, eventually it's all going to clump down to a beginning. So this was a huge change, a very controversial idea. The next thing that came up was a Jewish patent clerk that had too much time in his hands, his name ended up being Albert Einstein, came up with something called general relativity. And this was this really kind of exotic theory. Well, how can we test general relativity? Well, one of the predictions was light will be bent by a strong gravitational field. Well, the only thing they could think of to look at is a star on the far side of the sun, as the sun's huge, would have a large gravitational field, could bend that starlight and visually shift the position of that star. Well, how could you ever see that? Because the sun's so bright you can't see the stars next to us. Well, if you wait till a solar eclipse, the moon positionally just perfectly blocks out the sun, would allow them to see the stars that are just on the edge of the sun to see if their expected position is shifted from the gravity of the sun. So they had to wait till the next solar eclipse. A team went down to Brazil, took some measurements, came back. They saw the star that was shifted. Einstein's theory predicted it perfectly. Einstein is now catapulted into celebrity status. One of the predictions of general relativity is that we live in an expanding universe. And this was something that Einstein even found hard to accept. So you get these two things. You get the discovery of the redshift, that a universe is expanding, general relativity, and you get what's called Big Bang cosmology, that you run the clock backwards, the universe had a beginning, and now we put that date at about 13.8 billion years ago. So this was a very controversial theory. It's blatantly theological. When you have a beginning, that implies a beginner. A lot of resistance to it for two reasons. One is it's just bizarre, a complete shift in thinking, but a lot of resistance for philosophical reasons, because it's a very has huge theological implications. Primarily, people viewed it as having Christian theological implications. So now with this Big Bang theory of our views of time, we went from the one view of time, the steady state model, to three views of time. The linear infinite view, which is the steady state, there's still people holding out for the steady state model saying, hey, something else is explaining this redshift. The linear finite view, which is Big Bang cosmology, that, hey, there was this beginning back there. You can only go back in time 13.8 billion years and kaboom, something happened. Now, interestingly enough, cyclical shows up on the scene. And the reason being is they thought, well, if the universe is expanding, you've got gravity slowing down that expansion. Possibly, eventually, gravity's going to slow down that expansion so much, it's going to pull everything back together, everything's going to come screaming back together and implode, and it's something they call the Big Crunch. At that point, could the universe possibly bounce, for lack of a better word, and have another Big Bang? So could our Big Bang cosmology be one of these Big Bang cycles? So you have those three views. The steady state view fits very well with naturalism. No beginning, no need for a beginner. The linear finite view fits very well with a Judeo-Christian viewpoint of things, of time being linear and time having a beginning. The cyclical view fits very well with Eastern view in Hinduism. It's kind of a sense of reincarnation, the universe reincarnating itself. So now you've got those three views of time on the table. Well, late in the 1970s, we realized that before I get to that, in 1964, there was something that was predicted called the cosmic microwave background radiation. Don't have time to explain what it is. It's just kind of one of these neat things physicists kind of discovered. It's an interesting story because they predicted it, but the guys that actually found it by accident. But anyhow, that sort of cinched the deal for Big Bang cosmology. Steady state model drops off, except for a few holdouts for philosophical reasons as opposed to scientific. So now you're left with linear finite, and the question is, are we going to have this Big Crunch? Well, in the 1970s, we get some better measurements of how fast the universe is expanding, realizing it's expanding too fast. We're not going to have a Big Crunch. We're left with Big Bang cosmology. So here's what we know now about our universe, and this is where it gets bizarre. The universe began roughly 13.8 billion years ago. It started at a single point and expanded outwards. Now, that's wild to think of that when given that we have roughly 100 billion stars in our galaxy and roughly 100 billion galaxies in what's called the observable universe, which is how far we can see. So that's just pretty mind-boggling to think. It was a single point beginning. It wasn't like it began a little bit here, it began a little there, just boom, it all began. The universe is going to continue to expand. It's not going to collapse on itself. Matter and energy began at this point. They came into existence. This is really wild. The expansion, and I wish I had more time to get into this, it's not like things expanding into empty space. The fabric of space itself is expanding. So prior, at the Big Bang, the dimensions of space began as well. So to say what was here before the Big Bang, there was no here. Now that's a really wild thing to think about. The fabric of space itself is expanding. What also is bizarre, the dimension of time began at the Big Bang as well. So to say what was here before the Big Bang, there was no before, because there was no time, at least the way we view time, at least the way we deal with the dimensionality of time. So this is like a major beginning of everything coming into existence. Not only what's in the universe, the fabric of space and time itself. And physicists that have looked into this, that have come up with what are called the space-time theorems of general relativity, realized that this had a cause, what they referred to as a causal agent, that transcended space and time. So we have something blatantly theological. Okay? So how do we know this? How is it we can see this? Well, we can see this because we can look out in a telescope. That is not trivial, the fact that we can see far distant objects in the universe. Most stars exist in what are called globular clusters, tight batches of stars. If we're in a globular cluster, we'd have so many stars around us, we could never see these far-off objects in the universe. Most places in our galaxy are clouded with dust. It'd be like trying to look in a long distance in a fog. We wouldn't be able to see too far because of the dust. We're in a dust-free zone. Most stars reside inside our galaxy where you wouldn't have a window seat. You'd have too many stars to try and see out of. When the edge of our galaxy allows us to both see out of it, but also to look back in to learn about our galaxy. So, also, most galaxies are packed in what are called tight galaxy clusters. It would be like having a window seat in New York City. You look out your window and you see another building. For us, we would look out the window seat of our galaxy and see a nice, beautiful view of another close-by galaxy, but can't see around it to see what's far off. So we are in a very rare position spatially, the fact that we have a rare window seat in a galaxy that's not too clustered with other galaxies, that we can see things in what's called the far field, far off distant galaxies, which has allowed us to learn about the redshift and different things like this, to learn that the universe had a beginning. The other thing is, time-wise, if we showed up much sooner, there wouldn't have been enough time for the cosmic microwave background radiation to reach us for us to learn about that. If we go farther in the future, the universe will have expanded so much that these far different objects will be too far away, moving too fast for us to see. We won't be able to see those things as well. So not only are we in a rare opportunity spatially, but we're in a rare opportunity temporally. It's not trivial that we've learned what we learned. Is that a coincidence, or is that something that transcends space and time, that creator of the universe saying, hey, I want you to look at the heavens and look at the handiwork of what I've done. So how can we get some more insight of what lies beyond space and time? And now what I want to do is I want to go into the laws of physics. And do the laws of physics give us a clue? Is there something with an intelligence and a rationality out there, or are we just part of some random mindless process? I want to give you two examples. One is going to be understandable. The other is going to be techie, and some may be understandable. But let's start with the understandable one first, and I want to talk about ice. Water is an extremely rare substance in that it expands when it freezes. Most substances, as a liquid, when they get colder and become a solid, they get denser and sink. The fact that ice floats is not only very rare, it's vital for life on this planet. Think what happens to lakes in the winter. It gets cold, the top of the water freezes. Okay, it starts freezing a little bit more, you get a layer of ice. Ice is a very good thermal insulator. Now you've got this layer of ice acting like a blanket, keeping the rest of the water below at a fairly stable temperature, which allows fish to survive and to live and survive the winter. Now think if ice didn't float. Each night you would have a layer of ice form sink to the bottom of the lake. Now because heat rises within the lake, the warm water would stay atop, the cold water would stay below. You would never get any warming to remelt that ice during the day. The next night, another more ice forms and sinks to the bottom. Within a few nights, that lake would turn from solid ice by filling to the bottom to the top, kill all the fish. That would even happen in our oceans, especially in the Arctic. Over the centuries, the arcs of the oceans would fill up from ice from the bottom to the top and take it farther south. And only in the summer you get a very thin, shallow lake of water. So you would lose a huge amount of life on this planet if water didn't expand. Another thing it does is the fact that it expands. When our continents form, you have all this hard rock that needs to get broken up to make topsoil. The water gets in a crack, freezes, expands, cracks up the rock. That allowed continents to break up, that allowed topsoil to form. So basically, if water wasn't one of those extremely rare substances that expands when it freezes, you probably wouldn't have much more than insects on this planet. I would doubt you'd have mammals. And I'll leave that to you two to think out, knowing that all your lakes and most of your oceans would be solid, at least during the winter months, and there'd be a lot less topsoil. Not only is it remarkable that ice expands, water expands when it freezes at just the right temperature. If it froze at a higher temperature, we'd run the risk of perhaps ice freezing in our bloodstream and causing all kinds of problems. If it froze much lower, water where the lakes would get too cold before we get that blanket of ice to have productive biochemistry, nothing would survive. So we have a fine-tuned temperature that ice freezes. So, is that by some intelligent agency that designed that, or is that some bizarre coincidence? Well, let me go now to a techie example, and what I want to talk now about is there's four fundamental forces in nature. I want to talk about two of them, the electromagnetic force and gravity. We all know what gravity is. Okay, this is where it's about as techie as I'm going to get, so kind of hang in there with me if you can. The electromagnetic force is what holds is the positive charge of a nucleus of an atom attracting electrons, and how positive protons will repel from one another. It's a very strong force, much, much stronger than gravity. In stars, what happens is, as gravity starts to pull gas together, it forms a star, that gas heats up, the gas becomes what's ionized, and you've got these positive hydrogen nuclei that eventually gravity is strong enough, a couple of them slam in together, create helium, and cause fusion and put out heat, and that's how the stars burn. If you were to change that ratio of the electromagnetic force to gravity, weaken it slightly, there would not be enough interaction. You would not have too many stars formed. If they did, they would either not ignite or burn very slowly. You'd have no life anywhere. If you would change that ratio and make that ratio tighter, where the gravity is stronger relative to the electromagnetic force, you would have stars form, they would react too fast and instantly explode. Either case, you would have no life in the universe anywhere, anytime. And that ratio is on a razor's edge. Well, how tight is that ratio, razor's edge? If you change that ratio by one part in 10 to the 40th, that's one part in a number of 1, which is 10 with 40 zeros behind it. If you change it that much, either way, we have no life anyplace. Now, I want to compare that monumental precision that we see with the best that human engineering can do. The pinnacle of human engineering at this point is something called LIGO. It stands for Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. At least I think I got that right. This is the best scientific minds working with our best knowledge of engineering, coming out with the best plan we can make, and over $1 billion in funding to build this apparatus. And that remarkably can measure to one part in 10 to the 23rd power. So that means just this one aspect of nature that I described exceeds the best that human engineering can do, by 100 million billion times more precise. Is that a signature of a mindless process, or a signature of something fine-tuning what we live in for the purpose of humanity? That is not the only example of fine-tuning, and remarkably, that is not the best example of fine-tuning and a purpose and a mind behind our universe. This isn't even on the radar screen compared to the best example. The best example, it would take way too long to try and explain it. So right away, we see that we have something that transcends space and time, creating our universe, and an extreme amount of design that we see in our universe. Now, we may as well all go home at this point. To me, that's a compelling case. but I promised you 8 areas of evidence, and we've only done 2. So let me go to the third. Oh, before I do that, let me go back to water now. When I talked about that water example, how did that grab you? How profound was that? Okay? Maybe that's a coincidence, maybe that wasn't. Well, now look at that, but don't look at that in isolation from what I talked about, the electromagnetic force versus gravity. When you see something that's apparently well-designed like water in partnership with this other techie thing that's just extremely well-designed, the two make much more of a compelling case. So when you leave tonight, if there's one thing that you remember, next time you have a soda with an ice cube floating in it, take the time to think about how remarkable that is. So let's go to the next area. I want to talk about the initial conditions of the Big Bang. The reason we've talked about that, yes, everything had a beginning. At the instant everything began, we've got these very fine-tuned laws of physics. That's not enough, because some people said, well, given the laws of physics, the universe was inevitable. Well, no, it wasn't. You need the right initial conditions, something called the mass-density ratio. We have all this stuff expanding out. If you have too much mass for the rate everything's expanding, you're going to have large stars form too quickly. You'll basically end up with things called neutron stars and black holes, no life anywhere in the universe. If you weaken that ratio of mass to the rate of expansion, you'll basically have gas expanding and not enough of it coalescing to form stars, and in either case, no life anywhere, anytime. I could get very techie in this example, but I think one techie example is good enough. I just want to mention this because it's not just the laws of physics, it's the initial conditions as well. So the 3 examples I've done so far have all dealt with that first moment in time when the universe began. The next one I want to talk about is going to take us from 13.8 billion years ago all the way up to the formation of stars and planets to our Earth, and we're going to talk about how do we get a planet like our Earth that's habitable for water. Now, I want to start with a deck of cards. If I have a deck of cards and I turn over a 6 of clubs, well, nothing really profound about that, unless the card before that was a 5 of clubs. And you'd say, well, yeah, that's kind of a coincidence, you know, the 6 of clubs right after a 5 of clubs, but you know, 52 cards in a deck, it's not out of the question. But if you look at, well, what did I turn over before the 5? And you see, turn over an ace, a 2, a 3, a 4, a 5 of clubs, now a 6. The next card I turn over is a 7. Pretty soon you're going to say, hey, that's not a random deck, that's been organized by somebody, by an intelligence. Okay? So one card is not a compelling case, but you would never argue a perfectly ordered deck. You'd never argue away that somebody organized that by just every card at a time. Well, that's not that profound. It's the combination of all the cards that makes it profound. Well, it turns out that astronomers started realizing that there's a lot of lucky coincidences that allow us to have an Earth that can support life. And they call this, they coined the term the anthropic principle, anthro meaning man. And the fact that everything we see in our universe and solar system looks as if it was designed as being home for man. This term was first alluded to in the 1930s, but first stated as the first written down as the anthropic principle in 1961, and from somebody who's an atheist. This wasn't theologians that came up with this. And it's kind of the idea, hey, we've got some lucky coincidences here. Well, as we've gone more and more, we see that there's more and more fine-tuning about everything. Well, it turns out, not just any planet can do. We live in an extremely rare planet that can support advanced life. We also have just the right moon. Not any moon would be help. It has to be just the right moon. We're around just the right star. We have yet to find a twin for our star, meaning another star just like it out there. Other stars have twins. Now, I'm not talking about like a binary star system, it's 2 stars close together, but, oh, here's a star, and way over here, there's one just like it, okay? We haven't found a twin for our sun is very rare. The neighboring planets in our galaxy, we need Jupiter, we need Saturn, we need the other planets just right where they are to sustain our orbit for a long period of time. Our star has the right neighboring stars. If it was in a galaxy cluster, we would have a lot of problems. You would not support life. We're also in the right part of our galaxy. Not any place in the galaxy will work. Turns out, not any galaxy will work either. There's only a few kinds of galaxies that could support a solar system like ours. Our galaxy is part of a galaxy cluster. Not any galaxy cluster would work. Every level we look at, we see fine-tuning in design. Let me give you two specific examples. Our sun's size. A planet like us has to orbit what's called the habitable zone, meaning the right distance from the sun that allows the right temperature for liquid water to survive on the surface. And there's actually several things that would require a habitable zone, not just liquid water. You make our sun any bigger, it's going to burn hotter. You have to move our Earth further out. The problem about to find the habitable zone, the problem is a larger star burns faster and is less stable. Its temperature changes over time. That habitable zone will move over time, and you can't move a planet. You couldn't have sustained a planet habitable for life for a long period of time. You make our star just any smaller, you make a star slightly smaller, it burns dramatically cooler. You have to move our planet a lot closer. You get what's called tidal locking, which is where one side of our planet would always face the sun. And that's what we see with our moon. Our moon is tidally locked. We only see one side of the moon. We never saw what the backside of the moon looked like until an Apollo mission threw a spacecraft around the backside. If you have a planet that's tidally locked, one side is going to fry, the other side is going to freeze. And Mercury, by the way, is in our solar system, is pretty much tidally locked. Either case, you're not going to get life. It's a really just-sized star. Also have just the right-sized planet. In our atmosphere, the early atmosphere that forms, you're going to have water vapor in it, and methane. You want to get rid of methane, not water. Water has a molecular weight of 18. Our gravity is just strong enough to hang onto water. Methane has a molecular weight of 16. Our gravity is weak enough to hold methane. Methane boils off. So several things about the size of Earth are fine-tuned. Well, how many factors are there? As of 2008, to get a planet that can support bacteria for a few months, 501 factors have been identified. To get bacteria, a planet that can support bacteria and recycle nutrients for sustained time, it takes 676 factors to support a planet that can do that. To support a planet, for a planet that can support advanced life like us, an advanced high-tech civilization, 816 factors have been identified, and this is old, this is of 2008. Now, most of these factors are profound. Yes, maybe like 1 out of 10 odds that you get that right. But just like the deck of cards turning over the 6 of clubs, you don't look at these factors in isolation. This is like a deck of cards with 816 cards in it. The chances of getting this by accident are just absurdly ridiculous, even with the amount of stars we have. If anybody wants a hobby, I can give you a PDF file that lists what these things are and will cite over 600 scientific journals that describe these qualities. This isn't made up data, folks. So again, are we seeing something that's random, or are we seeing the hand of Creator that's designed this place to house human beings? So before we go to our next thing, I want to ask you a question again. Does science play a role in what you believe? Or are you committed to a paradigm where there's nothing about science that's going to convince how you see the world and how you see spirituality? So let's go to the fifth factor. We want to talk about the origin of life. Where did the first single cell organization come from? Now, in a minute to go here, we're going to need to go for a walk. So I want you to have your walking shoes ready. We're going to be going for a little walk in a minute. What was the first single cell organism? Now, if you look at an evolutionary perspective, it all starts here. It all starts with that first single cell organism. What could it have been? The simplest life forms are parasitic, meaning they live off of other things. They require a minimum of about 500 genes. The next complicated ones are called heterotrophs. They eat other things. Well, you couldn't have had anything parasitic, first of all, because there wasn't anything to live off of. And you can't have a heterotroph either because there's nothing else to eat. So the next complicated bacteria that could have been the first life form is what's called an autotroph. These are bacteria that make their own food. Examples of these are what are called chemoautotrophs, which use different chemicals in nature to manufacture foods. We find these in caves and different things like that, or photosynthetic bacteria. That's a very complex factory, a minimum of about a 1,600 gene set. And a factory is a good description of it. Very complex, very complicated. And I want to give you an idea of how complicated this thing is. And let's get to DNA for a minute. I want to describe DNA, what DNA looks like structurally. Okay, imagine a ladder. Okay, you've got the sides of the ladder and the steps or rungs of the ladder. That's how DNA is structured. If you grab the top and the bottom of the ladder and twist it in a corkscrew, you've got how DNA looks, because DNA is like a spiral molecule. So the sort of undo the twisting aspect for a moment, because that's not really necessary to what I want to talk about. So think of the latter. The sides of the DNA are structural. The center cross members, like runs of a ladder, are what's called DNA's base pairs, and they're what store information. Now, how do you read that information? You slice that ladder down the middle and expose the base pairs in the center, and that's how DNA reads the information that it stores. So I want to now, because that DNA has to slice down the middle, switch from a ladder to a zipper. So you think of how a zipper unzips. It's very similar to how DNA unzips and opens. And the teeth of a zipper would be equivalent to the two halves of the base pairs in DNA when it opens up that store information. So think of a zipper. You've got the sides of the zipper that are structural, the teeth that store information. The problem is when a zipper zips up, the teeth interlace, where in DNA they don't interlace, they connect end to end. So zipped up, it looks like a ladder as opposed to a zipper. That's why I'm giving you both the ladder and the zipper picture. But for now, I want to talk about a zipper. So a zipper is a very good analogy of how DNA works. It unzips, exposes the teeth, which stores information to the cell. That is used to make proteins and do other miraculous things that cells do, and then it zips back up for storage. So we talked about our autotrophic bacteria, okay, as being a very complicated organism. That's the minimum gate of what you need out of the starting gate for life. On the equivalent of a zipper, if you were to make a zipper equivalent of the minimum DNA for that first origin of life, how long would that zipper have to be? Turns out, the 3 million base pairs are required for a minimum autotrophic bacteria. That's equivalent to a zipper 5 miles long. That's what you need out of the starting gate. So I want you to go for a walk with me. I want you to pull up those walking shoes. We're going to walk the Boston Trail, the Boston Freedom Trail. I don't know if anybody's done that on this trail. You got this nice little red line taking you through Boston. You follow that along. Imagine walking this thing, and laying on that red line is a zipper. After you've looked at, after you've gone an inch and a half worth of zipper, to get that exactly right, the odds of that by chance is like winning the Powerball lottery. Now, this whole zipper is finely organized. It's not that it can only be one way. It's sort of like a story. You could say Tom walked to the store or Tom walked to the market and get the same result. So it can't have substitutions, but it's a highly organized zipper. So you're walking the Freedom Trail, looking at these things, and looking down and seeing the zipper that just keeps going and going and going, and it's telling a story. It's not random. It has a purpose. It's telling a story. And you're walking along, you're complaining how tired it is, you're thinking, when is this thing going to end? And your legs are saying, I can do it a little less freedom at the moment here. And you finally get to the end of this thing, you want to go in a pub and grab a beer, but you realize, wait a minute, the zipper loops around a lamppost and it's going back the other way. The problem is the Freedom Trail is only 2.5 miles long, that zipper is 5 miles an hour long. Now before you can grab that beer, you've got to walk back along the Freedom Trail the whole way you came, looking at the zipper, and looking at that, it's highly organized to see what a 5 mile an hour zipper looks like. That is a very accurate picture of what the DNA for what could have been the first life form looks like. Now, is that something that just happened by chance somehow, or by some mindless mechanism, or is that something that's designed by an intelligence far beyond ours with a purpose for a planet that was designed to be habitable for it? So, where did this zipper come from? Where did this first life form come from? Well, there is a mythological account that you may have heard. And the mythological account you may have heard is this, that life arose spontaneously from a vast primordial soup. Now, why is that mythology? I want to give you two chemical terms, prebiotic and postbiotic. When you're talking about biochemistry, You can have a molecule that's involved that would be a lot like a sugar, something like this, that's involved in biochemistry. But a prebiotic form of that would be something, somehow that organic molecule formed from something that's not a life form. So if you have a primordial soup existing before life, that's what's called prebiotic chemistry. Postbiotic organic molecules are organic molecules formed by life. So can you have any? Can you have a primordial soup? Do we see a signature for any prebiotic chemistry out there? Well, it turns out when we look at our oldest rocks, we see signatures for organic molecules. When they show up, they're all postbiotic. We have never found a signature for a prebiotic primordial soup. It's not there. If it was there, we would see it in the rocks. It's absent. We don't find it. So, could it have possibly existed? Well, it's hard to prove a negative in most type of situations. A burden to prove would be to prove that somehow you could have got a primordial soup. Well, it turns out this is a case that we can pretty much prove the negative, that you couldn't have had a primordial soup. And I want to talk again about DNA, and I want to talk about a chemical called ribose. Okay, ribose is a 5-ring sugar, very similar to fructose. Glucose is a 6-ring sugar. The sides, a section of a DNA, which is a section of the side of a DNA and half of the base pair, is called a nucleotide. Well, the sides of the DNA structurally have one of these ribose rings in them. Okay, to some, ribose is produced by biological systems. To somehow, in chemists, it's difficult to make ribose in a chemical lab, but chemists can make ribose. To somehow figure some type of prebiotic chemistry that can make ribose is a stretch, and I haven't even heard of anything reasonably proposed for that. And just getting ribose doesn't solve the problem. That's one of a myriad of things. But even if you could somehow have some type of prebiotic soup that makes ribose, you've got a serious problem, and it's called chirality. Some chemicals have what's called chiral forms, and you think of your right and left hand. Just like ribose, you know, 5 carbons are each, or a hand is 5 fingers. But there's a difference between your right and left hand, they're mirror images of one another. Well, it turns out that ribose is a chiral compound. It has a mirror image form. And they call them like a right-handed and a left-handed form. Well, biological systems only produce one form of ribose. I believe it's the right-handed form. That's called homochirality, meaning in your pool of these chemicals, you only have the one chiral form. There's no prebiotic, any type you could conceive of, a prebiotic chemistry that could make ribose, it's not going to make it in a homochiral form. And if you have the different forms of ribose and you try and assemble DNA, it'll go together, but the DNA structurally is not going to work. It's going to fall apart. So you have this homochirality problem that is really an intractable problem, even if you could get ribose. You've got the same problem with most amino acids that form proteins. Most of those are chiral forms, and you need homochirality for those as well. So again, it's as much you can possibly disprove a negative. Here's reason why you don't have that primordial soup that you don't see. So for me to somehow believe that something as extreme as that first life form somehow came about by a random process from a primordial soup that we don't see and have every reason to understand why it doesn't exist, for me to hold that position would require a level of blind faith that I could never sustain. So I wanted to move to the next thing, and we're going to look at life forms. And here we're going to talk a bit about evolution. And here's where I want to question you. Are you willing to challenge the party line or just go with what you're told? Where did life come from? Was the diversity of life we see on this planet, was that the result of some mindless evolutionary process, or was it an intelligent agency involved? This is a very complicated topic to speak on. And to talk really significantly about evolution, even to an educated audience, I found I need to spend at least an hour teaching evolutionary theory. Very likely, even if you studied it, what you know is out of date and incomplete. And even debates such as evolution versus God don't make sense because, well, God very likely could have used an evolutionary process to create life. And there's a lot of people that hold that position and talked about theistic evolutionists. Also, if there is no God, evolution is most likely your best bet, but not all. There are some atheists that appeal to other things besides evolution. They're on the fringe, the minority, but they throw out some credible arguments. And even if you have a creationist scenario, evolution has still contributed to life forms. So really the question here is not that evolutionary processes take place, but to what extent have they contributed to life forms? And it gets very complicated. To complicate things more so is nobody can say for certain what evolutionary mechanisms can and cannot do. They're not fully understood. There's a lot we know about biology, but we're still in the infancy on understanding these things. And so nobody can say for certain what evolution can or cannot do. And so as an audience, what I would like you to do here is to learn to have an open mind in many senses. Think critically about this topic. And don't just buy into what you're told. Learn to think critically about this topic. The question is, it's not that, again, not that evolution, did evolution contribute to life, to what extent? So, can in a short time, I'm going to throw out a couple of significant things about this area that are credible, that I can explain in a short time. And the first thing I want to talk about is two categories of evolution, microevolution versus macroevolution. Microevolution is adaption, a small changes, like bacteria becoming drug resistant, moss changing wing color depending on their environment. Nobody debates this happening, okay? This isn't controversial. The next is what's called macroevolution, which is actual innovation. It's new type of features showing up. It's re-engineering of organisms. This is what people debate, is macroevolution possible? So to say, well, do you believe in the evolutionary paradigm? Well, it depends on what you're referring to. You just can't blindly use a word as evolution refer to the whole thing. Primarily for the rest of this talk, if I talk about an evolutionary paradigm, I'm going to talk about macroevolution. So the mechanisms for any evolutionary process, three things are going to be at play. Gradualism. You can't have things suddenly appearing. Think about that long strand of DNA. If you need massive changes, you have to have a series of small changes and mutations over time to get what you want. You can't have rapid changes for something that exists being shut down. What's called a burnt bridge mutation, kind of like a Burt defect, but maybe that somehow it has viability as a creature. Second thing is intermediate forms must be survivable. Okay, you can't have intermediates that are weakened, and that's a minimum. In reality, they must be have a better ability to survive than their predecessors. And the last thing is evolution has no plan unless you're talking about a guided theistic view. You can't say something is evolving towards something else. It's a mindless process with no plan. So I want to go back to the idea of macro versus microevolution and give you my distinction between the two. Now this is Perry's distinction between macro and microevolution. You're not going to Google this and find this. I'm not saying it's worth a whole lot, but it just works for me. And that's the giraffe. A giraffe seems very feasible. You can imagine like a horse type of creature somehow getting taller, okay, over time. If there's a competitive advantage for being taller, you can imagine something like that slowly getting taller and end up as a giraffe. And that, as it slowly gets taller, would be a microevolutionary change. But what happens is, as that horse gets taller, you reach a limit where it cannot get any taller unless you re-engineer that creature. And that's a macroevolutionary change. The giraffe isn't a taller horse type of thing. It's a re-engineered creature to be tall. And let me explain one of several reasons why. How on earth do you get blood to the head of the giraffe? Okay? You've got to have this pretty massive heart to pump blood up that high. So you give it a massive heart. Well, that causes a problem. That giraffe at some point has to drink water. Now, if you ever stood up and bent over to tie your shoes and you kind of feel all the blood rush into your head, or you've been leaning over and you stand up all of a sudden and feel lightheaded, well, you're only moving your head about 3 feet. Imagine what happens when a giraffe drinks water. It's going to get an instant stroke unless you do something. Well, it turns out giraffe has valves engineered into their neck circulatory system to help regulate blood pressure in the head. To me, I see those valves as a dividing line between micro and macro evolution. I cannot see a naturalistic evolutionary mechanism that can create those valves. You just can't have a valve popping into existence. You would somehow have to get there gradually. Circulatory systems are very fragile. Anything that's a partial valve would be potential for blood clots, would get filtered out. And that's also only one of several factors you would have to re-engineer to make that giraffe taller. So I can't prove that a giraffe couldn't have evolved, but I invite you to just take that simple, this one simple example, and think that out, okay? Is that something that could happen by a mindless process? Well, another way to critique could evolution have been sufficient is to see what we see, what would it predict in the fossil record. You'd expect life to show up gradually, start out simple and get to complex. Life shows up about 13.8 billion years ago as bacteria. 540 million years ago, we have what's called the Cambrian explosion. Leading up to this point, you first had single-cell organisms. Then you start getting what's called simple multicellular organisms. And these are what's called a colonial aggregation of cells that aren't differentiated, meaning you don't have different types of cells, sort of like sponges and jellyfish, this type of thing, very simple organisms. Yet the Cambrian explosion, now we have what's called complex multicellular. You have organisms that have different types of cells, like we have a muscle cell, we have nerve cells, we have fat cells, some of us have too many fat cells. We have all sorts of different cells that we need, blood cells. We've got what's called complex multicellular. And the Cambrian explosion, the Cambrian period lasts for about 30 million years, but at the start of it, we have an explosive amount of diverse life, complex life, showing up out of nowhere. It's referred to as biology's Big Bang. Let me throw out a term called phyla. Phyla is a massive category of life. Like, for example, we have what's called bilateral symmetry. We have a right and left side. Starfish have a radial symmetry. They don't have a right and left side. So they're in a different phyla. So you have these huge different categories of life, okay? In the Cambrian explosion, we had more phyla suddenly appear than we have phyla today. Roughly about 50 phyla back then, animal phyla versus 30 phyla today. The Cambrian explosion was all marine animals. And about 50 to 80% of the phyla that have ever lived appeared rapidly in the Cambrian explosion, and arguably all of the significant phyla that ever existed. That's not what you would expect from an evolutionary paradigm that expects things to become simple and they get more complex and get to diverse. And let me just show you how extreme this is. We're the most advanced phyla. We're what are called chordates, meaning we have a spinal cord. Of chordates, we're a subphyla or class called vertebrates, meaning we have a brain encased in a cranium and a spinal cord encased in vertebra. An example of a chordate that's not a vertebrate is a shark. They're what's called a cartilaginous fish. Their only bone is a jaw. But vertebrates, we're now in a very sophisticated bit of life. You go in the Cambrian explosion, you've got over 3 billion years of very simple stuff. Cambrian explosion hits. 2 to 3 million years into the Cambrian explosion, we see a fossil of a jawless fish, which is a vertebrate. That 2 to 3 million years is a blink of an eye in geological time. And again, does that seem like something from a natural process or something like an intelligence? And what we see, and this is true of what we see in the fossil record, innovation shows up suddenly without precursors, and for the most part, you see species showing up. Very little changes, not evolving, going extinct, and new species showing up. So I want to go to man now. Let's talk about man. Many ways I would approach this, and the term in paleontology for man is used loosely. When I refer to man, I'm going to refer to human beings as ourselves. So creatures like us showed up roughly 100,000 years ago, plus or minus 50. There are also other, more out of the class called hominids. There are other hominids, which are bipedal primates like us that walk erect. The most advanced one was Neanderthals, and you had Homo erectus and this type of thing. Now, there are several ways I would approach the question, did man evolve from an ape type of creature? I've only got time for one, so I'm going to talk about from the jump to a hominid. And you've all seen these drawings of you have an ape that slowly starts to stand up, it's hunched over, and eventually gets some type of caveman, okay? So how do you get from a hominid, from an ape to a hominid? Well, apes are what are called knuckle walkers, and this is a pretty remarkable design. If you take your hand, you've got a hand that can be used for grabbing things, and make a fist. The front part of your fist now can be a walking surface, sort of like a horse's hoof. which gives you a stable surface to walk on, but still the ability to open up to have a hand to grasp things. So that's what apes are, they're knuckle walkers. Well, how do you get from a knuckle walker to get to a hominid, something that's erect like we are? Well, a number of things that have to happen. As you're standing up, the position of where the neck attaches to the skull, okay, has to move to center the head on the top of the neck. You also have to have a restructuring of the bones of the inner ear for balance, because now the head's going to be upright as opposed to hunched over. The spine has to go from acting like a bridge to acting like a column. You've got to restructure the spine. You need to introduce a lumbar and a few other things. The rib cage has to be reoriented for different use of the arms. The pelvis has to be reshaped for being something that stands erect versus designed to walk hunched over. You need to restructure the lower limbs. The angles of the femurs have to be different. Knees have to be strengthened. The foot has to be restructured now for a different angle. The muscle attachments all have to change. They have to change different positions. Now, if any of these changes happens partially, that creature is going to be to a huge disadvantage of a knuckle walker. Right away, natural selection is going to filter it out. If you have one of these changes but not the others, again, you've got something that is going to be at a huge disadvantage. Natural selection is going to take it out. You've got no way that you can get a gradual process. All these things have to happen at once. And that's why in the fossil record, we see nothing that is partial bipedal. We see eight knuckle walkers and we see bipedal hominids. You do have different types. You call facultative bipedal, which are bipedal creatures that can still move forward and knuckle walk, and obligatory like us, which can't knuckle walk, but they're all fully functional bipedal. So many things I could get into in human origin, but we're running out of time, so I'm going to go to the last category. So before we approach this last category, again, I want to ask you one last time that question. Does science really play a role in what you believe? Do you place philosophical constraints on what science is going to tell you, or are you willing to look at an open mind and look at all the data? Do you selectively use science to justify a position, or do you look at everything? And are you willing to fully look at what you've learned? So the last scientific push, the last category, brace yourself, we want to talk about a Thanksgiving dinner. Now, I'm a food guy. I've never tackled trying to cook a Thanksgiving dinner. It's a monumental task. You've got the turkey that's got to cook all day. You've got potatoes that cook at a certain time, beans that cook at a certain time, jello that has to be cooked and then chilled. And everything has different timing. The trick of a good Thanksgiving dinner is to get everything ready at once, to get all of those plates to line up. Not only do you need those things to all line up, but you need to do it when the guests are there and ready to eat. That's the struggle, is the timing of everything. Well, it turns out, if we look at our Earth and everything, we have remarkable timing that was required to get to what we have. And I want to talk about two aspects. The first is the sun. The sun, when bacteriophage showed up 3.8 billion years ago, the sun was very unstable, kicking out harmful radiation. Nothing but bacteria could have survived anyway. Since then, the sun has become more and more benign. The sun is about 50,000 years ago entered into its most benign and stable phase, and that's right around the time human civilization started to appear. Okay, and that's going to last for about another 50,000 years, and the sun's going to become unstable again. So human civilization, out of 3 billion years of life, and the sun's about 4.5 billion years old, shows up within this 100,000-year window just at the right time. The other thing, let's look at the Earth's rotation. The Earth rotates in 24 hours. Well, when the Earth was first formed, it was rotating in about 4 to 6 hours. The Moon has slowed down the Earth's rotation. And about 100 million years ago, the Earth's rotating about 23 hours a day. That's going to cause a lot of problems because you've got much more severe weather systems because the winds are stronger, and the changes to the trade winds would have more sporadic rainfall, you would have less usable land. Now we're rotating at 24 hours, which is about the ideal time. in another 100 million years will rotate at 25 hours, which will mean you'll have a higher difference between day and night temperatures, and you'd have less places that you can have habitable land. So we're not only at the right time for the sun, we're at the right time for the rotation period of the Earth. So the other thing that's remarkable when you think about it, just like a Thanksgiving dinner, there's no reason the turkey's magically going to be ready right when the mashed potatoes are. There's no reason that ideal rotation period for the Earth winds up with the ideal period of the solar cycle. And you've got several factors like this of these windows that were at the right time and they line up and humanity shows up. So I want to close with this thought. If you were invited to a Thanksgiving dinner where a host carefully prepared that meal, had everything ready at the time, wouldn't you like to get to know the host? I encourage you, we live in a universe of remarkable design and that everything's been organized where we're here at the right time. Wouldn't you like to make an effort to get to know the host of the universe? Thank you. Okay, here's what I'm going to do. We're going to go into Q&A. First, there's three websites. My main website that have a lot of recordings, awakenedbyscience.com. Okay, Dan in the back has cards that has that on it if you don't have anything to write down. I'm part of a larger group. Their website is reasons.org. If you want to do any big research, go to that. I have a temporary domain, veryperry.com, is for different things. I'm going to put up a recording of this talk and a recording of the Q&A. Okay? So we're going to take a break. The banquet starts now at 7. If anybody needs to leave for the banquet, go ahead and leave. And now I'm going to go into Q&A. Last time I did this Q&A was 90 minutes, and I'm willing to go 90 minutes if you don't throw us out. Okay. So go ahead and leave to the banquet.